it's very difficult for people who didn't live during that time to understand the craziness that was going on. There is no logic to any of this. Mm-hmm. How we had to go to the back door. I mean, all this was in statute, in the law. And that was true as late as 1960, to be honest with you. My experience in the Navy and all the racism that I faced there in the Navy was what really prepared me for what happened in Atlanta. Once the Greensboro sit-in occurred, it was covered in the Atlanta papers around the 3rd of February 1960, and I saw it when I was eating my breakfast down there, and I went to my good buddy Joseph Pierce and said, Joe, we ought to do this in Atlanta. We should not allow those kids in Greensboro to be by themselves. He said, I agree. And so then I met this young man named Julian Bond, who told me all about being a Time magazine intern. And so when we started the movement, I told Joe, we've got to get someone who can write well. I said, and that young man over there can do it. Let's go get him. Mm-hmm. And we went over there and talked to Julian. And Julian said, well, somebody's going to do it. I said, Julian, how about us?
Ms. Curry, you earned your B.A. in history from Agnes Scott College in Decatur, which was an all-white, at the time, women's college. How were you first made aware of the Atlanta student movement?
I was probably more open even at Agnes Scott because my parents were born in Ireland, and when we moved to Greensboro, North Carolina, they couldn't understand, you know, why black people had to come to the back door. They didn't understand any of it. So I was attuned to the fact that it was a weird system. Then I heard about the Atlanta movement. Well, I was working for an organization called the United States National Student Association.
I got this call from this white woman one day who said her name was Connie Curry. And a part of her job was to find ways for black and white students to kind of work together, so forth and so on. And so we asked her to come on into the movement, and she is still with the movement.
Just be in the right place at the right moment.
And I remember when I went down to Richard's department store to start the boycott in June of 1960, I asked her to go with me. And I said, Connie, I want you to come and be an observer. Just in case we are pulled out of here and you can at least tell somebody what happened to us.
Yeah, it was the Magnolia Room
right.
At Rich's downtown.
And for those that are not aware, the Magnolia Room, a very popular restaurant.
Oh, yeah, in downtown.
It was the cream de la cream.
And I was over up in front of the elevators because I was, quote, an official observer. I could see what was happening. And then I called lawyers, and I would tell them what happened. But anyway, so we were there that day. And Lonnie and them were sitting in the Magnolia Room. And I turn around, and right next to me is standing Calvin Craig, who is the head of the Klan. And, you know, my immediate thought was, dear God, when Julian and Lonnie and all my friends from the movement come out of Rich's, please don't have them all turn around and say, hey, Connie. Do you know they caught on immediately? They must have recognized this Klan person, because they came out and never looked at me.
What could have been the repercussions of your being identified with the movement?
Historically, particularly for Southern white men, a white woman and black men is absolutely a red flag.
And that's
taboo. Taboo.
So that would have been part of the anger when a white woman got identified. It goes way, way back. I knew Dr. King pretty well. He was very smart. He had a really good sense of humor. You know, sometimes I think he's sort of made into this image that leaves out who he really was. I was working on the Poor People's Campaign, which was the last project that Dr. King was working on. He had a committee meeting in the basement of the Ebenezer Church, and he was shaking hands and talking to somebody with his right hand, and I came up on the left, and he turned around and stuck out his left hand. He said, excuse my left hand, Connie, but it is the one closest to my heart. But that's my last memory of Martin Luther King. Next day, went to Memphis and was dead, you know. but he's glorified and idealized, and people don't know what a human being he was.